Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Suddenly, American academia looks like one of those neighborhoods full of shiny McMansions and shaky foundations, colleges and universities whose numbers just don't add up. Endowments down, tuitions up, college president salaries grating, and a vanishing sense of exemption from the forces hitting Wall Street, Main Street, and Detroit. This hour, On Point, the crunch hits the American campus. You can join the conversation, can the American way and cost of college education go on? And how do we protect and retool this great American asset? We will hear in a moment from two of the nation's big experts on higher education affordability and financing and what the crunch means for the way colleges and universities do business. Joining me first today from Washington is Paul Thain, senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He covers college administrations across the country. He's been writing a series called Sticker Shock about the cost issues closing in on American colleges. Paul, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me here.
It really does feel, from all the headlines, like the crunch is really hitting home in American colleges and universities. What's going on out there?
Well, this is a $375 billion a year industry, and increasingly, even before the recession really hit, the buck was being passed increasingly to students and their families. There are several funding sources that colleges depend on that have been down, mostly the government money from states and the federal government. But also their endowments have been really hit lately, some as much as 40%. Harvard, which is the endowment that everybody likes to point to because it was so huge, $37 billion, lost $8 billion in just the last 4 months.
$8 billion. And, I mean, they're hardly alone. I'm looking here at University of Virginia, down $1 billion in just 4 months. Middlebury College, Vermont, down 14.4%. Grinnell College in Iowa, down 25%. Its endowment. Amherst College, Massachusetts, down by 25%. These are really precipitous falls.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. Some of the schools that have been hit the hardest are the wealthiest schools because they have such huge endowments they rely on to build new labs and new campuses even. But some of the more strapped universities are also really hurting because of endowments that they use to rely on in tough times.
By strapped, do you mean public universities or private or both?
Correct, both. Public universities, since state governments have really been reducing how much they pay for higher education, on average, I think about 23% of public universities' budgets come from the states, and that's way down from the historic model. And a lot of people don't realize that. I think for a lot of people, the idea is that this is all taxpayer money going to public universities, but they too have endowments. You mentioned the University of Virginia, which is a very wealthy one, but you know your average regional public university will have really worked hard to raise private money for an endowment that they use to try to control costs.
Is there some kind of breaking point here? We read this big report that came out last week saying college costs up 439% in the last 20-30 years, while the median family income at that time went up only about a third that rate. I mean, have we just gotten to the point, public or private, where American families don't have the assets to keep pouring that kind of gas into this machine?
If there is a breaking point, I think we're there or we're almost there. Tuition and fees have outpaced inflation, healthcare costs, and family income for a decade, and this is definitely now a very hot issue. Unfortunately for colleges and students, the colleges themselves are facing serious financial challenges and are going to be tempted to increase tuition, you know, quite a bit precipitously, precisely at a time when families themselves are going to have a harder time paying for it. That said, I do think college remains affordable for the majority of students. You know, the average debt load for a student after getting a four-year degree is about $22,000. That's not as much as it might sound when you compare it to a car. And obviously, this is a purchase that really helps your earning potential. And about a third of students have no debt. So students are still going to school, but I do think the issue is coming to a head right now.
Though it could be pretty intimidating if you don't know where you're going to get a job to begin paying that loan off. We're talking about hiring freezes, salary freezes, building freezes at many American universities.
It's a time of intense uncertainty, and the funding sources are really frozen or drying up, and schools are trying to cut back as much as possible. The problem is most universities, particularly the public universities, have already trimmed a lot of the fat. You've probably heard about the high number of adjunct professors, non-tenure-track professors. Mm-hmm. I think about half of students are being taught by non-tenure-track students, and I don't think the average person realizes that. I think they think that universities are really living high on the hog. And, you know, that may be true for some of the wealthier universities, but I think the average institution has really been cutting back for a long time.
Paul, stick with us. We want to get the perspective of a couple of people who have been looking very closely at this for a long time and intensely in these recent weeks as the crunch hits home. Joining us from Philadelphia is Joni Finney, professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. She's spearheaded the effort to create a nationwide report card on college costs called Measuring Up. It's produced by the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education. Their headline-grabbing report came out last week, showed college has become increasingly unaffordable for families. She's author of the forthcoming book, Financing Higher Education in an Era of Global Challenge. Joni, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks very much for being with us. And with us from Charlottesville, Virginia, is David Brenneman, professor and economist at the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education. He's one of the country's leading experts on issues of financing in higher education. David Brenneman, thank you for being here.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So how do you describe the point we're at, David? I mean, is there a business model that's been at work in American higher education that's now, you know, reached the end of the road?
It's certainly at a major bump, let's put it that way. I think the business model that's, as Paul Fain suggested, I think accurately, that's been operating sort of without a lot of fanfare, sort of quietly year by year, has been a steady push of the price and the cost of college onto students and families. You could, in the extreme, talk about this as a form of privatization. That overstates the point, but I mean, it's certainly been a sense that the benefits of higher education accrue to a considerable degree to the recipient, and therefore the recipient should bear more of the cost. So state governments have been scaling back the share of their support, and tuition has borne the brunt of this. And the question is, I think, as we look ahead to the generation coming on board in the next decade or so, is this a sustainable model? And I think that's where the questions lie, as many of these young people come from families that are not particularly wealthy.
Joni Finney, in recent weeks, as we've seen so much economic trouble in this country, one thing that people have pointed to as a pillar of long-term American strength and a reason for optimism on the other side of this recession, depression, whatever we've got here, is that we've got one of, and maybe the world's best university system. Now, are we in a situation where the economic underpinnings of that are in trouble?
Well, I think so. I mean, what we've seen since 2006 when we last did this analysis is the United States slipping in terms of the completion rates of young adults from higher education from 8th to 10th. And so we really need to be concerned about our competitiveness. I think our international reputation is built largely around the research of American universities and the selective admissions. But other countries are really outpacing us in terms of just the education of the larger population, and that's where we need to be concerned, because we also at the same time have 78 million baby boomers moving toward retirement. And we right now, based on current performance, don't have the capacity to replace the knowledge and skills that will be vacated by left because of the baby boom retirement. So we have to worry internationally, but we also have to worry domestically.
Paul, do you hear college administrators asking whether they've been, you know, sort of ridden this pony as far as it will go, the combination of economic factors that have that American universities have come to rest on? I mean, does it still work?
there's quite a bit of anxiety about there. We're hearing even public universities doing some hand-wringing about how their budgets are set up, discussing new ways to track costs, things to strip away out of their budgets. I think the real question, of course, is how high can tuition go? How much are people willing to pay for an education? Obviously, the elite private universities, some have gotten up to $50,000 a year in tuition and board. Who's willing to pay that? And I think for public universities that have been historically very affordable, the University of Florida, for example, is about $3,700 a year for an in-state student. That's not enough to maintain what they want to do at that university. So there's going to be some tough questions about increasing tuition levels and who can pay it.
And now, Joni, your report giving Fs to 49 states flunking the affordability measure, Joni.
Right. Yeah, well, I want to pick up also on Paul's point that what tends to happen at the state level with public institutions is during a recession, they take a disproportionate cut compared to other state government services because they're able to raise tuition. During economic good times, they get a disproportionate increase. So while the states have been a pretty good partner, I would say, of public higher education over the last 40 years, the volatility has become a real problem for colleges and universities. And we've always had enough money to sort of cover up this volatility because we've pushed tuition much higher, I think, than any of us thought it would go in the public sector. And we may be at a point where in the public sector we can't push this too much more, at least in regional state colleges and universities.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American colleges and universities in big trouble in the midst of financial crisis and maybe the end of an era on the American campus. Paul Fain is with us from the Chronicle of Higher Education. Joni Finney from the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. She's spearheaded the effort to create a nationwide report card on college costs called Measuring Up. You may have seen the headlines that came out of that last week. Her forthcoming book is on financing higher education. David Brenneman is with us from Charlottesville, Virginia, and the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education. David, you are our economist. I mean, is this of a piece with what's gone on Wall Street, what's gone on in the housing market? Have colleges been living on the same bubble that's burst there?
I think not to the same extent. There was nothing, even in the student loan world, that seems to me to have been analogous to the subprime mortgage market. Although certainly student debt had been pressed hard as a source of financing, and indeed the whole securitization of student loans, which is the same mechanism that took the mortgages and the auto loans and so on,
mm-hmm.
That market has dried up for student loans right along with the rest of those securitized markets.
I mean, that looks like a connection to me right there. The credit flooded this thing. They got glossy at the same time that the market got glossy. Maybe families were even borrowing against home values at some level to make this happen. All gone.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, the home equity loans, even youngsters charging parts of their tuition to credit cards, was happening. So I think you're right. I mean, I think to some extent the availability of relatively low-cost money helped to fuel a lot of this increase. But I don't think the collapse is going to be quite as dramatic as it has been in housing. For example, the federal government is really the principal guarantor of most student debt, and the Department of Education has stepped in and has through their direct loan program is continuing to extend credit. So the credit crunch hasn't hit the colleges quite as hard as I think it's hit other areas.
Joni Finney, remind us of what you found in your recent report about affordability, and do you think that tuitions can go up more, that people can borrow more to kind of keep the whole game going?
Well, I think we're reaching the limits. What we found is if you are a family making above $70,000 a year, since about 2000, tuition and room and board costs, sort of your total educational costs, have taken about 7 to 13% of your income. I mean, it's increased from 7 to 13%
okay.
percent over that time. So those people can probably afford this. But what we're finding for those students attending a public community colleges, tuition now requires anywhere from 20 to 49% of their income, depending upon the state they're living in. To attend a public four-year institution, it requires 25 to 55% of annual income. So I think we are, this is after all financial aid, by the way, so I think we are reaching a limit here in terms of what students and families can really contribute.
Paul Finn, I think some people will look at those numbers. I mean, up to, you know, half of family income required to send your kid to college, and then look at executive compensation at a lot of colleges and universities and see another parallel with Wall Street. You know, we've all seen the news about million-dollar salaries plus more than that for college presidents and big increases even at public institutions, Paul. It grates at a time like this.
Oh, it certainly does. It's a largely symbolic issue. You know, you'd have to add another zero to these college president salaries to be paying them Wall Street level salaries. But I do think it's a symbol of many institutions perhaps being overextended. You know, they are mini cities, multi-billion dollar in some of the larger cases, where they have costs that range from police forces to buildings to flour. I was looking at a community college that had seen a 100% increase in the cost of flour, and that actually hurt them. But
flour for the cafeteria to make, exactly. I don't know, rolls or something, bread.
Yep. And but I don't want to absolve universities from all responsibility for this cost crisis. You know, a lot of them are sending out mixed messages. They're saying, hey, we're cash strapped, but we just hired this coach for our football team for $3 million. And that definitely grates at people. It certainly grates to see that the college president's making $1 million. And I think for a lot of the strivers, I mean, this is an issue that doesn't get talked about a lot. This is a very competitive industry. All these schools are looking to jockey with each other in the rankings and are maybe building and buying things they shouldn't be to try to get a leg up.
One more climbing wall than might absolutely be necessary for that great higher education. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Let's go first to Greenfield, Indiana, and Lee. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, I've worked in the student loan guarantee agency world and for banks specializing in student loans for 20 years.
Okay.
Now, your guests have very accurately laid out a great deal of the problem as we're facing it right now. We've been on trajectory for decades. There are College Board studies that show that we've been very near double the rate of inflation in tuition growth since the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, since the mid-50s. It is a very serious problem. And a lot of blame to go around. Parents are not doing due diligence. Students are not really comprehending what this cost of education really means. Schools have had carte blanche to raise tuition for a very long time. And other organizations, business, the public sector, have taken advantage of the information revolution. There is now distance learning, which is coming on the horizon. And the rest of the world has been able to adapt and to adjust and to make cost savings. And somehow we're still teaching in classrooms with professors when a disruptive technology comes along. Why aren't we using that?
Lee, do you see the party ending now or changing? How do you see the crunch hitting?
Oh, people are tapped out right now. There's been a lot of debt that's been issued, and a lot of people are defaulting on that debt. Official default rates only take into account the first 2 years after graduation. But if you go 5 years out, you see that at every level, community college, public university, private university, those default percentages are far, far higher.
Lee, thanks for calling. Paul Fain, are universities worried about kids just not coming back next semester? Is direct a consequence as that, Paul?
I do think, particularly right now, universities are waiting with bated breath to see who comes back in January and beyond. And I think, you know, right now there's a lot of uncertainty about how bad this could be. But again, I mean, I think an important point is that 80% of undergraduates pay less than $9,000 a year in tuition and fees. That's a lot of money, and that's going to feel like a lot more when the economy continues to tank, if it does indeed. But I think for most students, it's still affordable, if you choose the right option, that is.
And heaven knows, people need that education. Let's go to Ann in Wayland, Massachusetts. Ann, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great topic. My husband and I were just talking about this yesterday because we're going to be faced with this for our first child in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my feeling on this is, you know, when you're just going for an undergraduate education, this stuff is pretty basic material. You know, my husband and I went to engineering schools when we were young, 30 years ago. And, you know, the material, there was nothing new and researchy about most of that material at the undergraduate level.
Mm-hmm.
And half the time you'd have a big lecture, like in chemistry, and then you break down into these smaller rooms, and it's a teacher's assistant, you know, doing most of the stuff.
So what's your sense of why it's costing so much?
I don't know. I'm wondering, are parents today subsidizing all this graduate-level research, subsidizing paying for the famous professors who staff and do research and publish out of that university, which has very little to do with the undergraduate education? And I think it's about time we got back to the primary business of educating these undergraduates. And, you know, so what is the real cost
mm-hmm.
of that four-year undergraduate education?
And let us pick it up, and good luck saving for it. David Brenneman, this is in your wheelhouse. Is there a back-to-basics path here that could save everybody's bacon, or are we beyond that?
Well, I think another piece of your overall topic is this business model broken. If you look at the system, the push, the drive, the mission creep, if you want to call it, of institutions to try to be like Berkeley, like Harvard, like UVA, research universities, that's very expensive. And it is clearly the case that undergraduate education cross-subsidizes graduate education and research to some degree. I don't think there's much dispute about that.
Is that a bad thing, or is that an important thing for the country?
And it's not new. I mean, that's mm-hmm. been going on for, you know, many, many. In fact, any institution that ever tried to start just as a graduate school couldn't survive. Johns Hopkins tried that many years ago and mm-hmm. had to bring in undergraduates. So that's not new. What's perhaps as troubling is the notion that somehow the country has to keep adding to the number of research universities. That's a very stupid move on the part of the nation right now. We've got enough, and we should be taking care and making sure those institutions stay strong. But the wannabe institutions that are sort of trying to get their, you know, move into the graduate domain, that ought to be repressed at every level. And the focus should be, as the caller indicated, very much on the bread and butter work of doing undergraduate education.
To hold the line maybe on the basics, let's get a call from Fort Myers, Florida, and Marion. Marion, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to second the idea about executive compensation. It's not uncommon for a university president to earn a salary higher than the governor in the state and have so many benefits like housing provided. Also, I used to administer grants, and I used to notice that when a state would be freezing salaries for state employees across the state,
mm-hmm.
the university people who were receiving their funding under grants would always write a 5 or 6% cost of living adjustment in their grant that they would get. And one other thing, when my son was going to college, I remember asking a university people, what is your placement rate for these particular fields? And I remember being told, we're not worrying about jobs. We want to teach people to think. Well, I think that's pretty archaic, because the community colleges, even though my son did not go there, they have a very high placement rate. And in this job environment, we've got to think about, for all the money we're investing, what are we getting back in the form of salaries?
Marion, you're thinking very concretely there, and who can blame a person? Many people are right now. Joni Finney, what about this critique of compensation in universities? I mean, I don't know that world that well, I guess. Beyond presidents, we don't think of the numbers as being so big. Certainly not big numbers for adjunct professors. Is compensation in line or not, Joni?
Well, I think there has been an issue with executive compensation, and, you know, that's fairly well documented, and it comes under criticism, especially times like we're facing now. Faculty salaries, for the most part, I think over the last decade or so, have kept up with inflation or have exceeded inflation, and faculty have done generally fairly well. Now, that can easily go downhill in a matter of one or two bad years. So I think we have to pay attention to what's happening to faculty salaries.
Let's get a call from West Hartford, Connecticut. And John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just retired after 38 years as a faculty member in higher education,
mm-hmm.
and I've seen decades of college executives, administrators, pricing their product, the college education, not in line with their costs or the market, and in total disregard for parents' ability to pay, but in a mad competition with each other, climbing walls, laptops, whether you need them or not, food in dining halls that are equivalent to one-star restaurants sometimes, and I'm exaggerating. But my question is this, aren't at least part of the wounds, part of the problems of higher ed, self-inflicted by college administrators, just like the wounds of the auto industry are self-inflicted by decades of executive malpractice?
Let us look at it. John, thanks for calling. Joni Finney, what do you say to that? Everybody's heard about it. It's certainly not all colleges, but at some, this gold-plated deluxe life, students have come to expect the competition around the rankings based in part on that. Malpractice, says John.
Yeah, they are self-inflicted wounds, and they're also driven by these external rankings, such as those published by U.S. News and World Report, where colleges want to get up in the rankings. And so the amenities you offer and the selectivity of your student body matters. So there is this kind of insane arms race. I would also say once we get to the salary level of presidents that exceeds, it's close to and exceeds $1 million, what happens then to the second level administrators is everybody who's not making $700,000 or $800,000 thinks that they're underpaid.
Mm-hmm.
So it ratchets up the whole system, and it becomes very difficult to sustain.
And on it goes. Paul Payne, what about that arms race? Can that be ratcheted back down? I mean, a lot of places have already built those expensive facilities, have committed to that kind of a lifestyle that helped them in those rankings.
Yeah, unfortunately, there are no easy answers in this dilemma. And just to give you an example of how this can be extremely tricky, I've done a lot of reporting on the presidential pay. And when you look at some of the folks near the top, these are the most successful presidents that universities want to keep for a decade. That's kind of seen as the ideal length of term. And mm-hmm. the reason that people will say that they're paid so well is that they're the fundraiser in chief. And in many cases have been very successful at bringing in many times more than their salary.
Right.
So, you know, you do have this pay-to-play mentality. And now that does not say that some of these schools, again, are very overextended. I think particularly in the ranks of the strivers, you see some buildings and some programs that have been taken on that just aren't cost-sustainable. And I do think we're going to go through a period of some tempered expectations.
I mean, there was a time when people thought of college years as a year, you know, years when you lived maybe in a garret. You used a bunk bed. After World War II, that education that got educated, David Brenneman, a lot of them went to college in Quonset huts, you know, thrown up quickly during and after the war. It didn't have to be so fancy.
Well, see, this is part of the dilemma when you start pushing more of the cost onto families and students, is that then they rightly start expecting a level of amenities that they feel in part they're paying for. And to some extent, the part they aren't paying for, if they can argue for it and get somebody else to pay for it, then they win. You should see the move-in at a major university these days compared to my era. I mean, when the electronic gadgets, the flat-screen TVs, the small refrigerators, I mean, it really is, the living standard and the expectation of a great many students has been ratcheted right up along with the rest of the country.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about American colleges and universities in big trouble in the midst of the country's financial crisis and maybe the end of an era of a certain kind of lux life on American campuses. We'll see. You can join the conversation. How do we fix this? Should we go to school in Quonset huts again, like after World War II? And will the lush campuses of the 90s soon look like historical artifacts? Was yours so lush? Maybe not. Joni Finney is with us from the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. She's been one of the national leaders in looking at college costs and the reasons behind them. David Brenneman, looking at the economics of American university and college today, professor and former dean of the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education. Paul Fain is here from the Chronicle of higher education. Joni, you said that, you know, you're worried about dramatic declines in college enrollments, that people will just check out of higher education.
That's right. And I think it's important to put this in perspective, too, that half of the students in the country are enrolled in community colleges. So they're not at these institutions that are in these huge arm races to the top. But they're still finding it very difficult to pay for higher education because of volatile public support. Another 70%, total 70%, we have enrolled in public sectors generally. Now, it's the research universities that are very much part of this arms race, and as Paul has mentioned, the strivers. And it's those institutions that we've got to keep focused on a mission of teaching and learning, I think, if we're to see our way through. And I just want to make sure we understand that not all students are at universities where they have the climbing walls and are taking flat.
Absolutely, and plenty that just need to get the sidewalks patched up. But you've noted that states have kind of, many states have lost that community college safety net. Those were there, they were affordable, and now even at community colleges, you've got fees approaching public university levels, Joni.
Yeah, that's right, and the debt levels are growing. So I think we have a real problem with, and we'll continue to have a problem with the enrollment of low-income students and access to an education that was possible for almost everyone, regardless of financial means, 30 years ago.
David Brenneman, you've talked about this country maybe needing to change the culture, the assumptions around university education, sort of in the way we turned nationally against smoking, or the way now we're thinking about fossil fuels and energy. What would be the target of that change?
Well, that's a very interesting point. I have given some thought to just observing how the country over a 15 or 20-year period really reversed itself on smoking. What was normally assumed to be the case suddenly became verboten. And whether changing the attitudes toward what one expects from college, what institutions have to provide to be competitive, whether we can get back to, as one of my former colleagues used to say, a kind of a basic stripped-down Chevy as opposed to something with all the, you know, the bells and whistles added on that would be more affordable. That means taking on this arms race mentality, which does permeate the system, and it's not much of the spending that it generates is not publicly or socially beneficial.
And continue to be plain about this. When you say arms race, you mean all the kind of deluxe amenities that colleges, well, some have layered on in the race to stay competitive in rankings and desirable for those high tuition paying families.
I'm talking about basically a model of prestige maximizing. In other words, you want your institution to be the top of the list, and that translates into hiring very high priced notable professors away from a competitor institution at a high salary, which, frankly, it doesn't matter whether Professor X is at Duke or at University of Virginia in the big picture, mm-hmm. but it makes a lot of difference to the two institutions. So we spend money on the status symbols that dominate our particular ranking systems, and some of that money is not money well spent, I would say. And Paul referred to this, that's a hard culture to break, and I don't know any of us have figured out quite how to do it yet.
Though there's nothing like an economic crisis to do it, or an $8 billion loss in an endowment.
That's, I had another colleague many years ago who often said what the country needed every so often was a good depression. Yeah. You know, it sort of bring us back to our senses, and right now we're seeing massive air going out of balloons in every direction, and this may not all be bad.
Though you hate to wish it on anybody. Let's get a call from Debbie in Chesapeake, Virginia. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a son who is just finishing his first semester at community college here, and the one thing I'm really hoping with all this economic disaster is that Obama can really follow up on his pledge to give kids money for doing community service. I think that would be good for the kids as well as for our country.
Right. Let's look at that. Debbie, thanks. Paul Fain, what about it? Debbie remembers what Barack Obama said on the campaign trail, talking about a kind of a deal, public service for college tuition. What exactly was proposed, and is the Obama in readiness camp still talking about it, Paul?
Debbie's not the only one who's looking anxiously to see what the president-elect will do in terms of what he expressed somewhat vaguely would be a real commitment to helping students and families pay for college, whether it be through community service or increasing Pell grants. Or, you know, one thing that doesn't get talked about a lot is, you know, some of this, you know, spending to stimulate growth. Will some of this be in the form of federal research money that universities are reaping and using and can really help their overall budget? Can I take it back to your original question, though?
Yeah.
One thing related to, you know, has the market finally caught up to colleges?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing that colleges have always been immune from is the market pressure of going out of business. You know, these are remarkably resilient institutions. In the business world, you make a bad investment, it might be the end of your business.
Right.
Harvard predates the United States, but many of these institutions have been around hundreds of years, or
mm-hmm.
you know, even the run-of-the-mill institutions have weathered some really tough challenges. I think this one might be a little different, and I think it's going to make some universities question whether they can keep on doing business as usual.
I mean, literally going out of business, hanging up a out-of-business sign and abandoning the campus?
Well, you know, that's a thing we hear periodically over the years, that there's going to be a wave of closing of small private colleges, and it never really seems to happen. Antioch College did shut down, though. I know that's kind of an outlier,
mm-hmm.
but it caught people's attention. It did show, you know, this can happen even to a very reputable, well-known school. I don't think that's going to happen, but I do think you're reaching a tipping point where business as usual will not cut it. And at a certain point, people will not pay tuition. You can't keep on adding, whether it be through tuition or raising private money, because it's just not there.
That would get people's attention. Economist David Brenneman, do you see, I don't know if there's an equivalent of bankruptcy for colleges, but do you see that as a risk?
Well, Paul's exactly right. I think the one group of institutions that historically and today are at risk potentially are small private nonprofit colleges. They are the ones you don't see public institutions shut down. I think I can only point to one in the entire history of the last 40 years. So it's an issue of small privates, and but they've, as Paul also indicated, there's a remarkable resiliency in that market, and they've adapted. I did a look back over the last 40 years of how these small privates have stayed alive, and they've found a new angle about every decade. Now the question is, what's the next big new angle? And I don't know what it is, but historically there would be some suggestion they'll find something.
There are cycles at work here. Have you ever seen a down cycle, though, as imposing as this one in all your career, David?
No. If you look back across the past four or five recessions we've had, usually one about every decade, institutions actually have come out of these, if anything, maybe not stronger, but they've weathered them well. Enrollments have not fallen. In fact, normally during recessions, enrollments tend to go up because people, the opportunity cost of, you know, if you're not working is less.
Might as well go to school.
You might as well go to school. This one is beginning to shape up as if it's something different. I think we are, you know, you're hearing John Maynard Keynes' name used again after years of neglect. I think we're reflecting this thing has depression-like possibilities in it, and how that, I mean, again, higher education weathered the depression, but there was a lot of job sharing and wage cuts and things we haven't explored thus far.
And a lot less of it than there is today.
Well, yeah, it was a very small enterprise in the 20s and 30s, and now we're into mass higher education, and it's a very different ballgame, but I think that's what's probably got everybody a little bit rattled, is that this one does feel and seem a little different than the recessions we've gone through in the last 40 years.
Let's get a call from Boston and Derek. Hi, Derek. You're on the air.
Hi, Don. How you doing?
Well, what do you know, Derek?
Well, I just tuned in, so forgive me if I retread some ground that was already covered. But I just finished my undergrad education.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Well, I went to an out-of-state school, so I had a little less public funding than I might have had if I'd stayed in-state.
Yeah.
But the reason I chose the school I went to is because it was $12,000 a year, and
okay.
I knew I'd be taking out loans for most of that, so mm-hmm. I thought I could afford $12,000. Well, by the year I finished, it was $25,000 a year.
It doubled while you were there? Was this a 2 or 4 year or what?
That was 4 years. I actually did a 5-year program,
mm-hmm.
but I finished it in 4 years because I couldn't afford to stay anymore.
Doubled in 4 years. That's just off the hook, Derek.
That's how I felt. I mean, I never would have gone to that. Like, the reason I chose that school is because I thought I could afford it, you know. And so now, instead of feeling like I have a leg up, I have these crippling student loan payments that I don't know how I'll ever be able to get a mortgage or anything.
So you must have tens of thousands in debt.
Oh, yeah.
Are you happy for the deal you made?
I can't say I regret going to college. I got a lot out of it, but I feel like I might have been misled almost by high school teachers and by, I mean, even my parents, God bless them. I feel like I was sold a bill of goods that wasn't what I was actually getting.
Wow, that's rough. Derek, thanks for the report, though. Thanks for calling in. Let's get one from Port Charlotte, Florida. And Tom. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great panel. Great points. And Eric, gee, he just brought up an awful thing. I have a situation. I'm kind of on the periphery here. I have two granddaughters just entering this coming fall. They're 1-2 in their class.
Great.
Four plus GPA.
Yeah.
They want to go into pre-med. Their initial assessment financially. Now, their parents are, I guess, lower middle income.
Okay.
One's a teacher, yep. One's a firefighter.
Yeah.
They're looking at $80,000, $100,000, $120,000 debt when they get done. And this is maybe $80,000 just from their regular four-year school. Because they're in a catch-22 situation, they want to go to a really good job, really good college,
mm-hmm.
that's going to get them into their med school,
sure.
whatever branch of that they decide to go into, which ends up being a very expensive school. And they're,
right.
you know, everything's going to be out of state for them. So, you know, that's another $15,000 to $20,000 a year that they wouldn't have to pay in state. Where did they go? What does your panel suggest on something? Right. Like
so
that?
You and they facing straight at that reality, and Grandpa Tom worried about it, and who wouldn't be? We'll look at it. Joni, what do you say to Tom in Port Charlotte, Florida? He's got two whippersnapper smart granddaughters there. They want to be, you know, go to med school, but the dollar figures look gigantic.
Yeah, you know, I'm not in the position to give advice on personal decisions, but I think a lot of schools, especially for good students, Tom, are providing scholarships out there, even if they do have to go out of state to offset some of the costs. I will say, over time, college has been a good investment. So, you know, it's risky to say that in an environment like this, because our last caller, you know, amassed a great deal of student debt and is coming out at a very bad time. But overall, it's still a very good investment. So, obviously, it's worth, you know, using loans and those forms of investment to pay for college costs. But I think these two callers just illustrate that the point that the business model isn't working. And I'd like, if we have time, Tom,
yes.
to spend some time talking about what an element of a new business model might look like for higher education.
Great, let's hear it.
Should look like.
Please.
Well, I just have a couple, and then I think Dave and Paul probably mm-hmm. can add on. One is, we've got to make better use of technology. In higher education, we have used that as an add-on, so to increase costs. But there are some wonderful models out there around the country, and in fact, a very large project that is looking how we use technology to teach classes where there are a large number of freshmen and sophomore students enrolled, while maintaining or improving quality and lowering costs. And they found a lot of success in it, so we know how to do this now. There are some great models. The second is, we've got to get some just restraint on the overall cost. They can't continue to outpace inflation and family income year after year. So we've got to create incentives at the state level for colleges to be more productive with the resources that they have and rewarding them for graduating more students, for lowering costs and things such as that. I think another element of a new business model is one that both Dave and Paul pointed out, is we've got to get these institutions focused on a mission so they're all not becoming or trying to become research universities, where we're actually rewarding them for focus on undergraduate education and paying attention to undergraduate teaching. And then, you know, the idea of the diversity of personnel, how we use tenured faculty versus non-tenured faculty, I think needs to be discussed. We shouldn't always assume that adjunct and part-time professors mean lower quality. I think used in combination with tenured and senior faculty, we can create a high-quality environment. And those are just some of the elements that I think need to be put on the table.
David Brenneman, we've just got half a minute here. Do you see institutions embracing that kind of profile that Joni Finney is describing there? Could that save the ship?
Well, it could certainly help, and I'd certainly second all of Joni's comments. The one final thought I might throw in here, which may sound completely Pollyannish, but we have been in this country on a 25-year ride thinking that taxes are all bad and public services are all wasteful and inefficient, and I would actually like to see state support for public higher education re-energized somewhat, and it's possible that Obama's development plan could include some funds for state and local governments to get back into this game in ways that we've maybe let them opt out.
Maybe, though, there are a lot of hands out, as we all know, for a little rescue action there. It's a fascinating moment, and it's been a great conversation. I want to thank each of you. David Brenneman at the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education. David, thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Joni Finney at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. Professor Finney, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Paul Fain at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Thanks so much, Paul.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.